Hey, it's Cindy Howes and Lizzie Ngo from the podcast Basic Folk, honest conversations with folk musicians.
Basic Folk is truly changing the game with our well-researched deep dives that aim to empower the listener while fostering the folk community.
I basically am writing worship music for youth group rejects.
Maternal regrets and maternal guilt are universal.
I try to make things that are beautiful and that are made with like a purity of intention.
You can listen to Basic Folk on the Bluegrass Situation Podcast Network or at basicfolk.com.
Thompson Guitars makes handcrafted instruments in Oregon. Their guitars are built with select tone woods, including Brazilian rosewood. Go to pktguitars.com for more information about their different models and appointments available from their custom shop.
Hi, I'm Tom Power. Welcome to Toy Heart, a podcast about bluegrass. So, we found ourselves at the end of season two of Toy Heart. Hopefully it won't take 3 years and the global pandemic to make another one. But I gotta say, it's been a pretty fun season. I want to thank you for all the comments on it. You know, people who listen to the show often talk to me about the show, and they'll ask me, like, oh, who's your white whale? Who is it that you would love to talk to that you never got a chance to talk to? And thanks to the kindness of the folks at the Bluegrass Situation and the kindness really of just the bluegrass community in embracing this podcast, we haven't had too many problems with that. But you might remember one of the answers was Tony Rice. I talked a lot with people like Bela Fleck and Jerry Douglas about how much I wanted to talk to Tony Rice. And then sadly, I didn't get a chance to talk to him, but I was very grateful that we got to talk a lot about him in our Tony Rice Remembrance Special, which you can find in our podcast feed. But my other answer when people would talk to me about who's the white whale, who's the artist you've always wanted to talk to, well, it's probably the most formative figure in bluegrass since Bill Monroe and Earl Scruggs. I'm talking about Alison Krauss. I think if you're listening to a podcast about bluegrass, I don't need to tell you why that is. I mean, she's a generational singer, fiddler, producer. Her albums have inspired countless musicians to come to this music. She was the female artist who won the most Grammys until Beyonce won her 28th Grammy. She's been awarded the National Medal of Arts, been inducted into the Bluegrass Hall of Fame. Her work with her band Union Station, Robert Plant, the soundtrack to the films like Oh Brother Where Art Thou, they're all modern day classics. But here's the thing. For all of her fame and all of her importance and all of her influence, she hasn't given a lot of long form interviews about her life and about her music. And after a lot of chasing and a lot of kindness from people, and actually telling her on an interview for my other show, Q, that I was a Larry Sparks fan, and you'll hear how much she loves Larry Sparks, we were able to make an interview happen. So the producer of this podcast, Stephanie Coleman, and I drove to a recording studio in Nashville, and we had a rental car, and I remember we were both kind of nervous. And we set up two chairs, and in she comes, and she was kind and generous and insightful and moving, and what an incredible life she's had in this music. So since this interview was recorded back in November of 2022, there's been some exciting changes to Union Station. That's all I know. There's more to come, but I can tell you, and I believe we're the first people to break this news, is that there's going to be a new Union Station album coming in 2025. All that to say, this is very exciting. This is the last episode of season two. If you want to reach the show, we're at toyheartpodcast@gmail.com. I just found the password for that. So it's toyheartpodcast@gmail.com. Here, from Nashville, is my conversation with Alison Krauss. Thanks for being here.
Glad to be here.
Nice to see you.
Nice to see you too.
I'm so excited to talk to you. We've been looking forward to talking to you for a while.
Thank you.
So I thought what we could do is we could just kind of start at the beginning, kind of go through some of the years, and then kind of end up here. And I think I've read about every article about Alison Krauss over the past couple of days, just getting ready for this.
No telling what's right.
I know. So if you've been lying to everybody.
Yeah, maybe.
If you've been lying to everybody, I got nothing.
Okay.
Here's what I find interesting about the beginning. So the story that I see in a lot of these articles is similar. That your parents, your dad is the child of a German immigrant, right? Both your parents are children of immigrants.
Well, my mom's father came from Italy. And my dad, who is now passed, both his parents came over in 1945 with he and his sister. And yeah, and they came after the war.
And they settled in Champaign.
No, they settled in Chicago.
Oh, okay.
They of course came through Ellis Island and ended up in Chicago area, in Oak Park, where they landed first and then ended up in Chicago proper. And then my dad went to college at the U of I, and he's a little bit older than mom. And then on her first day of school, my dad was working as the meal boy at the sorority, like an arts sorority.
Yeah.
And he gave her her plate. So that's rest is history.
No way. He gave her her meal there.
Her meal, yeah.
And they fell in love there.
I think it took mom a little longer.
maybe for
but
him.
I think it was pretty.
And so you grew up with grandparents who were from Europe. You grew up with grandparents who.
Well, my dad's dad was already gone.
Yeah.
And then my mom's dad was gone, I think, when I was two. And my dad's mom ended up in Washington. So, and then my mom's mom ended up moving to where we were in Champaign. But, you know, it was long distance in between.
Here's what I'm interested in here. So that the story is that they wanted to give you guys, you and your brother, I think it's only the two of you, a very well-rounded education. So they put you in like dance and they put you in sports, neither of which really stuck.
No.
and they put you in music lessons.
Yes.
And what I find interesting about this is that you had to pick an instrument and you had to stick with it for 5 years. I've heard of people like, you got to pick an instrument, we're going to give you lessons. But I've never heard of like, we're going to give you an instrument and you got to stick with it for 5 years.
I don't remember if she told us that we had to stick with it for 5 years, like at the time.
Yeah.
But that's what she said later, that she had heard that you don't really know if you don't hang on to it for about 5 years. It's how you're really going to know. Like, you got to give it that kind of time. And there weren't, you know, when you're little, there's not a lot of things to choose from. You can't play wind instrument. You don't have any power to do that. And so really the choices were, you know, kind of piano and violin. She didn't want Vic and I on the same instrument, just so we'd have our own, you know, experience. And yeah. That was it. She put the fiddle under the Christmas tree. She didn't want, you know, she wanted it to be fun, like the idea that it was exciting to do this and that this was a special thing and not something you had to do.
Why do you think it was so important for them to like, for you to be, I think in one interview I saw you, like, they wanted to seek out any ability you might have.
Yeah. And my mother is a very accomplished painter, graphic artist. And then on dad's side, you know, those things were not, you know, I think being coming to this country like they did with not having anything, that was not something you spent your time on, you know, extracurricular things or the arts, even though it was appreciated. His father played some music, but you needed to survive. So with that not being pushed there, and my dad loved music. The encouragement was the biggest part. That, you know, my mom said, well, you know, if you guys were going to be good at something, we were going to find it, which was great, you know, that you spent time doing that.
They wanted you to have these opportunities that maybe they hadn't been able to have when they were kids, or
you know, for sure on my dad's side.
Yeah.
But and also I remember my mom, she took a few different instruments. And she was sorry that she had quit, you know, that wasn't encouraged more. And I think that was another reason why she wanted to make sure we had that time under our belt, that like to be able to possibly play well enough to start to enjoy it instead of just in the learning process of it.
Did that come quickly? Like, did the I think we can all relate to the idea of picking up an instrument and not kind of getting it right away and then putting it down because we can't enjoy it right away, you know? Did the line between picking up the fiddle and like being able to enjoy playing the fiddle come relatively quickly?
I don't remember at that time, other than they were excited for us when we played. You know, they gave us a lot of praise for us playing.
Yeah.
So, you know, and I think, and it's funny because at the time I remember thinking everybody was doing this, all the same stuff we were doing, you know, and like when you met somebody, you, are you German? You know, what instrument do you play? And like, you thought everybody did the same thing, you know?
You thought everyone was German.
You know, and played. Or just whatever, you know, where are you from? Where are your parents? Not that we thought everybody was German, but that heritage was a big deal. And that taking an instrument was a big deal because that was a big deal, you know, in our house.
Did you play any of those old songs, like German folk songs or anything like that? Did you sing any of those around the house?
My dad did, yeah. Yeah, I could probably sing some for you. Not all of them were rated G.
Oh, yeah. None of them were PG. We'll have to put an 18-plus disclaimer on this thing.
None of them were. Yeah, some were.
So the fiddle comes to you. Like, the fiddle tunes come to you. It's like through a book, right? Like, you have a book of fiddle tunes that you found yourself to?
I was taking classical violin, and then Mom was looking for things to inspire us. And so she heard about a fiddle contest in Champaign at the county fair, and she brought it up to the teacher. And then we got a book that had some tunes in it. And that's where we started. And then I think right after that, we got Richard Green's album, Duets. We really like that.
So you heard that records. You had been playing kind of classical music for a really long time.
Well, but not really long.
Oh, you've been playing classical music though. You had been playing like.
Well, but I mean, like it was, I think it was 2 years after I started taking lessons and that we started getting into this bluegrass kind of contest fiddling. So, okay. I mean, I don't remember. I remember, you know, walking out, you'd carry your fiddle on your arms out stretched to, you know, where you wouldn't tire holding it up. And as little, you know.
Of course. But then you hear Richard Green and you say, oh, this is really interesting.
Liked it. It was really fun to listen to. The first song on that album is called Little Rabbit. We like that. And then, well, how do we learn it, you know? And so Mom, who plays by ear, plays guitar, sings harmony, she made a cassette recording of Little Rabbit probably 20 times on each side. So that, and she goes, okay, there you go. And she put down the tape recorder and she goes, there you go. And I'm like, what do you mean? She goes, well, if you can sing it, you can play it. And so I'm like, whoa. She goes, just listen to it. So I just listen to it over and over and over. And then, you know, like people do, you hear it and play it back, rewind it, play it back. So that was that.
God, they had so much encouragement for you, didn't they?
They were very encouraging, very happy, excited for us. And you know, we were very lucky.
Yeah, I can sense that. Did they take it? So you started playing fiddle contests shortly after that, right? Like,
yeah, I think the summer I was 7, we started.
And did you find a Did you find a sense of community there? I mean, this is a whole other world to me. We don't have a whole lot of that in Canada, like fiddle contests, especially in Newfoundland where I'm from. But Steph's told me stuff like this. And Sam Bush told me this the other day, that like he felt like, oh, you know, he was in high school or he was in junior high or he was in elementary school and there weren't a lot of people who were into this kind of music. And he didn't really talk about it. You know, it just didn't come up. And then he would go to these fiddle contests and be like, oh, my God, there's people like me. Was that your experience?
Exactly. Yeah. You didn't talk about it in school or whatever. But Andrea Zahn, she's from the sister town, Urbana.
Yeah.
And she was at that same fiddle contest. That was her first contest, too. And I remember watching her. She's a couple years older, so she was in another division. But I remember my mom and I watching and we're like, she's the best. And so later on we became good friends, and you know, it's definitely a different, you know, when you meet people who love old time music and traditional music, you know, they, but not everybody, but I'll say it, most of the people I know, you know, you're fascinated and long for the past, you know, and a simpler thing, and it's a timeless thing. You're always daydreaming, at least I'll say for myself, but it's all about like this other time that's already happened, and you dream about being back in there, even by the lyrics of the tunes, you know, it's just another place in time that's so romantic and inspiring, and you know, it's a different kind of longing.
Right.
You know,
and you felt that even then. You felt that even back then.
Oh, gosh. I just daydreamed all the time about songs. And, you know, I'd have the pictures in my head of where they were. You know, I remember, we'd drive. You know what it's like to be in Illinois. You know, it's flat and all cornfields. And it's just as beautiful in the summer as it is in the winter. And the winter has a sadness about it with nothing growing. And you see for miles and, you know, you're driving in the car and nobody was watching movies back then. You know, you talked, you sang, you listened to music, and I'd listen to, you know, Cold on the Shoulder.
Cold on the shoulder, and you know that we get a little older every day. Kick it around, take it to town, try to define what you feel inside. You better be strong, your love belongs to us. It's cold.
And Newgrass Revival and these people, you know, Joe Val.
What make you want to leave? You gave me your love and you gave me your vow. Now you're leaving me here to grieve.
The J.D. Crone, the New South album, and Boone Creek, you know, you'd be listening and those were your movies. Those are what you daydreamed about. And it was a beautiful place I went to in my mind, if that makes sense. I loved that.
Yeah. I know that sense of like there's another time. There was another sort of more romantic time that existed in the same area is what appeals to all of us, you know, when we get into this music. I love that those were the touchstone records for you. That like a lot of people I've spoken to, God love them, have been, you know, they talk to me about like hearing Bill Monroe on the Grand Ole Opry, or they talk to me about hearing Flat and Scruggs and stuff like that. But for you, it was that J.D. Crone, the New South record with Ricky and Jerry, right? That was a big one for you?
Oh, yeah. Well, actually, all the people in Union Station, except for Jerry, because he was there.
Yeah.
But all of us, that was the one, like, oh, that just changed your life.
And all the beer taverns all down along Young Street, the dreams of the seasons are all spilled down on the floor. All the big stands of timber just waiting for falling, and the hustlers sitting watchfully as they wait there by the door.
The guy, John Pinnell, who's written a whole bunch of tunes and actually started Union Station.
Yeah.
You know, when we first met, he would make me cassettes to listen to of all different people. And Ralph was on there, the Joe Vow and Boone Creek, all those people I was mentioning, the Whites, he'd make these cassettes for me to listen to. And that was on there.
Yeah. Those are crucial tapes. I remember Neil Rosenberg made me one of those tapes. I remember being like, I want to get into bluegrass. And he made me a tape of like Bill Emerson, Bill Monroe, only Bills. Bill Emerson, Bill Keith, Bill Monroe. Yeah. And it was like, and it was all those like, and I just, it was like a mix tape.
Yeah, it was incredible.
And it was incredible. And you just kind of realized, so that's how kind of bluegrass enters your life, like through that?
Through, yeah, John. I mean, I was doing the fiddle contest.
And you were winning. You were winning fiddle contests.
I mean, yeah, I mean, some.
So you were good.
I mean, I'd be scared to hear it. You know what I'm saying? But yeah, we loved it. We loved it. You know, those were so fun, and going there and hearing people play, and we'd record folks and the versions that they were playing. And Timmy Crouch, Dennis Crouch's brother, was so great. Randy Howard, and we'd record their versions of different tunes and go home and try to learn them because they blew your mind, you know, that kind of thing. And then it became just this, it was a great time to grow up at festivals and seeing those folks. And
were you putting in a lot of hours on the fiddle? Like, were you putting in a lot of hours of practice?
I didn't really like sitting around and doing that myself. I did a lot of as much or probably twice, three times the listening than I did sitting. And I didn't have that passion of sitting there doing that. I love to play in the band setting, and you know, you can hear it in my play. I did put the hours in by myself that I should have, but you know, I liked rehearsing and playing in the band and working out harmonies, and that was more passion.
You were singing by then. You kind of realized you could sing and sing harmonies and all that by then.
I think fifth grade, there was an Annie Sing Alike contest.
Yeah, I heard about this.
And
like Annie the Musical.
Annie the Musical is when the movie came out, and a lot of people, you know, a lot of girls were just fascinated with the Annie musical. And Andrea McCardle was her name, who sang the Annie part on that album. And she's beautiful. And it's just a very sweet story, you know, if you know it at all. Like, it's beautiful, yeah. And so I listened to that all the time. And there was a singing contest in town at the local public TV station, like as a promotional thing for the movie. And I think they did it all across the state of Illinois. And so tried out for that. And I became one of the orphans in this thing that would sing songs. And we'd, you know, I think we sang at Rotary Club, you know, things like that. And I think we sang at the state fair too, it just was to hear great singers. The girl who was Annie was years younger than the rest of us. She was 7.
Oh, wow.
And she was so good and like just totally inspiring to see and be up close to a really great singer. Yvette Cantanio is her name. And she, I think she's gone on to do more musical theater, but she was really spectacular, and everybody was blown away. Like after she got done, and I can't remember how many girls were singing, but we were all like, "Oh my gosh, she was so great!"
Yeah.
So that was like, you know, there was 8 of us that ran around and sang in that troupe, and it was
origin story, Allison. If you don't mind me saying, what a weird origin story for you.
Oh, it was amazing, but like, you know, like, oh, it was great though. But like, you know, inspiring totally. And then you see this little person who was spectacular, just raised the bar of, you know, never been close to anything that was that good. It was
and
pretty
that she
fun.
Was young,
you know, she was amazing.
And she seemed to be like a legitimate performer.
She
and
was
she's,
great.
Yeah, she was really kind of doing it.
But she blew everybody away. It was wild.
Because like, I did wonder a little bit about like just how young you were. Like, was it Silver Rail first?
Yes. Well, I played in a band. I'd play fiddle tunes. There was a guy in town, Marvin Lee Flessner.
And this is the band with your brother?
No. It's Marvin Lee Flessner. I had won the state contest, and he was kind of known in town. He used to have a public television show there in Champaign. And he would bring in young players and singers to sing on the TV show. Well, the TV show didn't exist anymore, and he had me come play fiddle tunes during his shows, like at the American Legion. I'd come play and then ended up singing a couple songs. And so he had me come do that.
Right.
And then after that, John Pennell and a guy named Nelson Mandrell, who went on to... He's written so many beautiful songs. Yeah. The two of them were in Silver Rail. So they were both from very different sides of kind of their perspective on, of their favorite kind of, like mentality of where they came from musically. John was more in a progressive side. His songwriting was, you know, influenced by the Beatles, and he was kind of pushing that traditional side. And Nelson played me for the first time Clinch Mountain Gospel.
Oh, yeah.
With, and like
with
that.
Keith Whitley, right?
Oh, gosh, yeah.
Yeah.
Have you seen the Rock of Ages? Jacob's ladder hanging down. The river of Jordan. Now, my son, I'm homeward bound.
That was, I'd never heard anything like it. I remember where we were, you know.
Where were you?
We were in his house rehearsing. And they were both musicology students writing 20th century classical music at the same time that they loved this traditional bluegrass. And so, like, he played that and, like, blew my mind. Like, it never, you know, like, scared you to death.
Yeah.
And so we were sitting in there. And but he came from that kind of Ralph side. And John came from the other side, the J.D. Crowe and all that. But it was amazing. They were so great and so, I mean, like to be around such great songwriters was incredible.
Yeah.
Like to watch that process and hear, you know, John would be working on a tune and bring it over halfway done and play it, you know, and it was incredible. Like,
and you didn't mind being in a band with people who were like 8-10 years older than you? Like, you didn't?
Didn't even think about it.
Didn't even think about it. That's what gets me here in this story. Just have like it's just so wonderful that like you were this kid going on the road too, like going on the road with like a band, you know, so young.
Well, I was lucky that they put up with it. I mean, when you think about it, it had to have been incredibly annoying.
Annoying, right?
You know.
Yeah.
I was glad to get to do it, and they, you know, just. You know, it's a not, I want to say weird bunch, but a peculiar bunch that love that message.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. We all sort of find one another, don't we? The people who like that kind of music, the people who are touched by that thing, all end up sort of finding one another. It's a really beautiful thing.
Yeah. I mean, it's funny. Sidney Cox.
Yeah.
The Cox family. You know, he sends me pictures of lyrics that he carved into a, you know, into a piece of wood, or, you know, I wrote this on the tree, you know, I'm like, ugh, you know, like, you know, so he sent it to someone else. They might go, why don't you go downtown and check yourself in. I mean, like, where we're going, oh, my God, that's all the train, you know.
I know, yeah. It's like the things, Conan O'Brien say that the things that make us money really should be treated.
Probably.
Yeah, they probably should be treated. So just to skip ahead a little bit. So then Silver Rail Classified Grass, which I watched last night, by the way, on YouTube at the Kentucky Fried Bluegrass Festival. You sound great, by the way.
Oh, gosh.
You sound great. You really do. It's really, it's awesome. And then it's like, is Union Station the band that you submit the demo to Kennerman at Rounder, the record to Rounder, or is that Silver Rail?
Classified Grass.
Classified Grass.
They were, and we, Silver Rail and Union Station, I'm trying to remember the timing. Classified Grass, they were in Indiana.
So save all of your tears, but someone who's lost, but who
I think I met them at the Battleground Fiddlers Gathering there, and they were so funny. And they were a much more progressive type band, and you know, Newgrass Revival was their favorite and one of mine. And they had the lady who started that or ran that festival, Pam Freeman, her son Scott was the guitar player. And so she was very much into wanting to get something happening for Classified Grass, where, you know, Silver Rail and Union Station, we played at home, and I don't remember us talking about sending anything anywhere. I don't remember that.
How did Kennerman at Rounder get this record that you end up getting signed from?
I think we cut 5 songs with Classified Grass, and my tune that I sang was number 5.
Yeah. What song was it, Tina?
I think it was How About You, the Newgrass Revival song.
Yeah.
Yes, he's all right. He's making do. He's doing fine. How about you?
And Pam had sent in to Flying Fish Rounder in Sugar Hill. Like, I mean, we didn't know what I mean? Like, I don't know what they knew, but just playing, you know, like we didn't know. And she was aggressively or thoughtfully, I should say, looking for something to happen for us.
Yeah.
And so she sent that in, and Ken Irwin said, and back then, their office, they all shared an office space, you know, a room probably no bigger than this. All 3 of them, the heads around her, were in the same room, so everybody would know what was going on all the time. And I thought that was a really smart thing. They'd have these cubicles, you know, covered with cassettes and stuff. And so he was listening to the Classified Grass demo, and then he said he made it to the 5th song.
Which, and no one does.
Yeah, it was just amazing, like, how it all... Anyway, so he made it to the 5th song, and then wanted to hear more things, so we went in and recorded another, I don't know, 4 or 5 songs of myself.
I mean, it must have been so exciting to get that phone call from Rounder, who were already a pretty big label at this point. I mean, they had put out that J.D. Crow record.
They put out the Richard Green record, so, which is fun because, you know, you remember looking at the turntable in the picture. Yeah. And it was exciting.
In the morning. I'm
How did your parents react to it?
They were excited.
Yeah. Yeah, they were pumped. They were proud. They were, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I remember being excited, but I remember, you know, more than anything, you know, wanting to do a good job. And I don't remember ever thinking that it would do anything else. I don't remember having any expectations.
Right.
You know, I didn't expect, first of all, to ever do this for a living.
Right.
And sure didn't think that that would necessarily come through.
You thought this would be like like everybody else, this would be a fun thing to do on the weekends while you know?
Yeah. I mean, yeah. But I don't even know if I don't know how far my thoughts even went.
Well, when you're 15, 16 years old, you know, you're not really necessarily thinking too much about the future, you know?
I remember thinking, just listening to that stuff, I just couldn't get enough of it.
Get enough of what?
Of those records, you know, like that was...
Yeah. Yeah. Were you... How do I put this now?
It wasn't as much about me doing it as it was about listening to it. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's the thing. I've talked to people who, that's what I'm trying to get together. It's like, I've talked to people who are like so incredibly driven. They're like, I want to be the biggest and you know, I want to be the biggest, most transformational country star in the, I've talked to people through the radio show who'll be like, yeah, I knew right away, Tom, when I was 7 years old, I wanted to win an Academy Award and I wasn't going to stop until I won an Academy Award. I don't know whose voice that is, but it's somebody's voice. Sylvester Stallone, pretty good impression. Tom, I knew I wanted to do it. The sense I'm getting from you, Allison, is that you were just like, the music was affecting you so deeply and the music you were listening to was affecting you so deeply and you loved it so much. You just wanted to be a part of that and you weren't thinking about anything else.
Yeah, I love to play it, but I didn't think it would ever end up being something that we'd get to do.
Yeah.
You know, or like I remember saying, I remember, you know, the first time I looked out in the audience and saw people singing words to our songs that only we had recorded, that was just a really crazy moment. Just never thought it'd end up being there. Never thought we'd hear back from Rounder.
Yeah.
Never thought we would hear from Rounder in the first place.
Yeah. And you were still in school. I mean, you were still in high school. You skipped the last couple of years of high school, right?
Well, I did an early admission program
right
into the University of Illinois that was specific to a music program. So it's not like
you were
like I was. Oh.
You weren't good. You weren't Goodwill Hunting. Solving math problems.
Going on like that.
That's yeah. When I read that, I was like, "Was she?
No.
Is Allison going around solving? You know,
yeah, that was not
calculus problems on the side of a bus or something like that.
There's nothing.
You were adept at music, so you got to go to this program a little bit early. And what? You were going to be a choir teacher, right? You were thinking about being a choir teacher.
That's what I. Yeah, that was my thought. I loved back in grade school that the lady picking the songs and working the vocals and
yeah.
And I was in a children's choir, like I think it was third grade, and we sang through there. And she would work those parts and change the vowels and make you think about things. And I loved all of that detail stuff she was doing. And
when that first Rounder record comes out, are you? That's a lot of touring, right? Like you were going a lot of festivals and that kind of stuff.
I don't think it was a lot.
No. I mean, maybe not comparatively to what you ended up doing, but was it more than you had done in the past?
Yeah. I mean, we'd play at a club called Nature's Table in Champaign, and then we may play at other things like the Homer, like a celebration, 4th of July celebration, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
But we didn't play out a lot. We went to, you know, Hannibal, Missouri, and we'd play. We played in Iowa one time, but nothing crazy. No, not till later.
When did that start? When did the craziness start?
Well, crazy. But I think we noticed that nobody had another job, you know, that this was the only thing we were doing. I think I was 18 or 19. That like, oh my gosh, nobody has another job.
Yeah.
You know.
That's a big moment.
Yeah, it was. Now, mind you, we were in a 79 van, you know.
Yeah, you weren't. you weren't in a big, beautiful bus.
No.
You know, or in a private jet.
You know, sleeping. Yeah. I remember, like, I'd lie on the floor, sleep on the floor, and then wake up and my face would be stuck to the rubber mat, you know, from, you know what I'm saying?
And the deal, wasn't the deal that you had to do like a bluegrass? I mean, we don't have to talk about this if you don't want, but like you would do a bluegrass record and then sort of like a solo record. You would do a Union Station record and then a solo record. That was the deal, right?
Well, that's what it was originally talked about.
Yeah.
And, but then I didn't, yeah, we just, Ken was extremely supportive.
What do you remember about that first Grammy win? You were like 19, right? What strikes me about that is that you were just like we're only talking like 6 or 7 years ago that you're talking to me about like going to festivals and playing, like, you know, playing with your friends and stuff like that, and like finding out more about Boone Creek and finding out more about Jada Crow, and then like 6 or 7 years later you're at the Grammy Awards. What do you? I've never heard you talk about that night. What do you remember about that night?
Well, I mean. Union Station had been nominated the year before for our record Two Highways. And I remember like the first reaction, well, what are we going to do? We can't come up with it. Like, didn't feel comfortable to go, like, oh, where are we going? And then John wanted to go and Mike Harmon played banjo on that record, wanted to go. And, so then we went and we had it was really fun and crazy. And
you saw all these big stars.
Well, I mean, it was just, it's like things you wouldn't even, gosh, that night Ken Irwin was there, was very excited that next year when that record won. I mean, you didn't even think, it wasn't even a possibility. It just didn't cross my mind.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? Yeah. Like,
so I think like what I was interested here is just that you were just in a van touring in a band. Well, all this stuff that like in retrospect seems to be these really big moments, but you were just touring. You were touring a lot. You were doing a lot of festivals. You were just playing. You were playing.
We were just playing. Yeah, yeah. There was something that was that Kentucky Fried Chicken Festival.
Yeah.
The guy that was hired by Kentucky Fried Chicken to put on that festival,
yeah,
was Bob Jones, who put on the Newport Folk Festival.
Yeah.
And he liked our band.
Yeah.
And then hired us to play the Newport Folk Festival. And because we played that, we were able to play out east because that was a really big deal. Like, I don't know how we would have ended up having those gigs out there in any other way than he had done that for us.
Yeah.
And that was a huge deal where we were able to play, you know, the Iron Horse and the, what's that? Well, but there's a bunch of clubs up there that we ended up coming back to years and years. And that was a huge deal that happened.
It was all pretty exciting at that point. Can we talk a little bit about, I wanted to talk a little bit about one of the songs. Can we talk about Every Time You Say Goodbye?
Falling.
Just, we were listening to that on the way here, or we were listening to that yesterday, and I was playing it on guitar last night. I ended up finding a lovely version of John Pinnell singing it on YouTube. Can you talk to me a little bit about a memory of that song? I feel like that's a song you probably are going to have to sing forever.
Oh, I love that song.
Yeah.
He, John, we were working on the album, Every Time You Say Goodbye, and we didn't, you know, like there's times where you go, oh, you're sitting there, like, we don't have everything. And that's happened one other time, because through the years, it always had been by the time we were finishing a record, I had everything for the next one. You know, like, you know, because it's all you were doing was listening and finding things. And it was just kind of this really wonderful period of time. Like, you're young enough where you're mindless enough that you're not even thinking about anything. That's all you're doing is that. So,
yeah.
at that point. And that was in, I don't know, 19, I don't remember when, what, 91, I think.
Yeah.
And we were sitting around and at that time too, those guys, all those guys that kept sending songs were really prolific too, because nobody had families yet.
Right.
You know,
right.
Like,
yeah,
they
yeah,
kept
yeah,
sending
yeah,
stuff. Yeah. And so we were in the studio working on what became that record, and he sent that or dropped it by because you couldn't send anything. You know, he had to give me the cassette.
Give me the tape.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I was like, whoa, you know, this is great. And it turned out great. I mean, it's always fascinating to me when, it's always, you know, you hear a song and that becomes, you know, you hear the first one that becomes the thing you then find everything and build the rest of the record around. And then you find the thing that becomes the next thing you build the record around. And that song was one of those where it became the standard for the rest of what got picked.
As much as it can, because I know that's sort of like ineffable and that's sort of like the magic of the process. But I've heard you say that before. And I'm trying to figure out a little bit more about that. So like, because I think one thing that gets talked about a lot with you is like your fiddle playing and then like your singing, but like your song finding ability is kind of unreal. And I don't know if people talk about it enough, that like your ability to find the right song and find these beautiful pieces of music. I was just listening to Windy City the other day and I was like, where the fuck did she find this song? Like, where did she find this like Leuven Brothers B-side, you know, like, and they're all incredible, you know? So can you talk to me more about that? Like so let's just start here. Like, can you define what you're looking for when you find a song? Is there anything more than a gut feeling?
I have to, it like instantaneously brings pictures. Like a movie, you know, you just instantaneously see it. And I think, my training from John and Nelson.
Yeah.
You know, like, them writing songs all the time and bringing them in there, and you're hearing the true life of these tunes. And then they didn't make up stuff, you know, they were real experiences to them. And I think, you know, that sense came from that process of,
yeah.
And but now, like, if it just instantly, it's a movie,
you know it immediately.
Yeah, like immediately. I mean, I'm trying to think. I don't know. Usually it doesn't take much finagling. You know, there might be little things, like you change a chord or a little tiny melodic thing, or maybe you'll go, hey, can you change this word because it's funny, or, you know, in there, or I wouldn't sing that, or it breaks the spell or whatever. But
it breaks the spell. That's lovely.
But that's true. It does, if it erases that whole feeling, you know. And it may not give somebody else that, but I know that feeling within myself,
right?
And they, you know, it just, they never make it. Or if something doesn't really give you that, or it remains a regret forever, you know, if you compromise that part of it.
Yeah.
But it never gets old to me if I have that initial, and it's just spontaneous, like bam.
Yeah.
I'm like, oh gosh, you know.
Are you doing a lot of listening? Are you like going through a lot of records trying to find them, or are you just waiting for them to hit you? Or,
well, I have found that once the first one comes,
yeah,
they just show up, and it's always been like that. It's not a labor intensive process is for finding them. It's always been that way. And even the people that, you know, that continuously kind of feed into our, you know, the band's material stuff, they just start coming. It's like everybody's on the same page all the time. Like, it's great. You know, there may be something that comes up, or, you know, I know a story, like, we'll use Sidney Cox as an example. I know so much about his family history.
Yeah.
Like, there might be something, you know, oh, hey, would you write this? You know, could you write this story?
Right.
You know, and, you know, that kind of thing. But that's enough to get him going. And,
yeah,
you know, where that's enough of, oh, well, this is going to see an outcome.
Yeah.
That will be inspiring. But it's always been the most exciting part of is finding those things is like, just, I can't even tell you. It's magical. And I suppose it, you know, for me to see that.
Yeah, I can tell how excited you get when you talk about it. Like, it's the best, you know?
It's, you know, when you feel inspired, there's, I don't know what else you can possibly compare the feeling to.
Right.
Like, true inspiration is a reason to live, you know?
Yeah, it's otherworldly. I heard the story that you, when you found the Cox family, it was like 6 o'clock in the morning.
When God dips his love in my heart. When God dips his pen of love in my heart. And he writes my soul a message he wants me to know. His spirit, all divine, fills a sinful soul of mine. When God dips his love in my heart.
Might have been a little bit later, but it was not appropriate.
What's the story there?
Mike Harmon, he is from Missouri, and he and his family have a band called the Harmon Family. And
yeah.
This was the other generation of it. He now does it with his sons. But prior to that was his sister and brother and
yeah.
and wife, and they would play. And they were at a festival and heard the Coxes there. And he recorded it because it was so great. And it was like a song and a half. And we'd play it in the van all the time because it was so good. And even I'd never heard anybody with that accent. I'd never heard some of the names. Like, they weren't common names.
Yeah, Willard.
Willard. And Sydney. Mm-hmm. We didn't know who, you know. And I was like, whoa, we're used to John and Mike.
Yeah.
And so, but they introduced each other. You know, or, you know, the dad was doing the intro. I'm like, oh, and then they sang songs they picked from other sources that were, you know, that they used to sing Sister Golden Hair and stuff like that. And you're like, whoa, you know, where's this? Like, just, we wouldn't have gone there
yeah.
with Union Station.
Yeah, I keep on thinking about you, Sister Golden Hair Surprise. And I just can't live without you. Can't you see it in my eyes? I've been one poor correspondent. And I've been too hard to find. But it doesn't mean you ain't been on my mind.
And so I was really fascinated. And there was no internet to look them up. I couldn't find their picture anywhere. That drove me crazy. You know, it's like, and then we'd never played in places that they played. They were Florida, Mississippi, Louisiana, Texas. That was kind of their land. And we were over here.
Yeah.
Illinois, Missouri, Indiana. And then we finally got booked in Texas and they were there. And I'm like, what? And that was like 2 years, I think, of listening to that cassette. So I was really excited to see if I could find them.
Right.
And so I just remember nobody was walking around. You know, like, I got up and nobody was walking around.
It was like 7 in the morning or
That's
something like
what
that?
I think it was, because yeah. no one was up.
Yeah.
You know, and then I kept trying to find somebody. And, do you know the Cox family?
Mm-hmm.
Like, asked to try to find somebody who knew them. And
then you found him.
Then I found him.
Yeah, and it was pretty magical. Hey, those records are still spectacular, you know?
Well, thank you.
I could love them.
There's nothing like them. And when you mentioned Windy City.
Yeah.
Windy City, you're holding my baby with your bright lights and your avenue so warm. Windy City, turn loose of my baby.
why I loved that song. It was the first song I ever heard them sing person.
Yeah.
And so that was just an incredible moment. We were all in a camper, and that festival was the first time I'd heard any of the original tunes that Sydney had written.
Yeah.
And they were standing backstage, yeah, Suzanne and Sydney, singing I've Got That Old Feeling.
I've got that old feeling you're leaving. I'm so tired of goodbyes. I can't wait on your love forever while you change your mind.
And so that's when I heard that. I'm like, oh, wow. And
that's where you got that song.
That's where I heard it that night at Perrin, Texas. Mm-hmm. And so we had hung out, you know, all of us all day. You know, it was so fun and very silly. And then we were just about to leave. And that's when they were standing there singing there. And I'm like, hey, will you send me every song you've ever written? I said to Sydney, and he did. And we cut four of his songs off that first tape that he sent.
Yeah. That's a beautiful story.
No, it was so fun. They were just so fun.
I love that gospel record. I put that on once a month. I probably listen to that record. I really do love it. I got something I want to ask you about, and I'm a bit nervous to ask you about it, but I'm going to do it anyway. Here's the thing I noticed about back when you were doing a lot of press around then, right? Like, so when things really start taking off, when Alison Krauss and Union Station really starts taking off, and those Cox Family records really start taking off, like, I find you're doing like kind of two kinds of interviews. You're doing national press interviews, like your big deal. And a lot of the questions are very much like, so what do you like about bluegrass? You know, I'm like, what is it about acoustic music that you think Americans like so much? You know what I mean? And you're kind of speaking on behalf of bluegrass music, you know, a lot. And then in the bluegrass world, you are just getting so much like, is this bluegrass? Is that, you know, you have piano on this record now. Is that bluegrass? Or like Alison Krauss is her new record has drums on it. Now, is that bluegrass? And people are writing into Bluegrass Unlimited and all this stuff about you. And I thought it'd be, now that we have a little bit of distance from that, it occurs to me that you were so young still dealing with all of these like kind of people asking you about the genre and to like define the genre and defend the genre and whether you were doing something different to the genre. Just broadly, like, what was that like for you?
Well, I didn't really think about that part. I never pretended that anything we did with drums or piano was bluegrass.
Yeah.
You know, I never tried to pretend it was. I mean, I was serving what I felt like. Not what I felt like. It was serving the song. What was, you know, that was above trying to fit yourself in a category to make people happy, which you can't second guess anyway. So, yeah. You know. I was finding songs I loved. We did them the way we thought we should. And, but I never pretended that, you know, stuff that we cut like that was bluegrass.
Why do you think it mattered so much? Like, why do you think people got so kind of...
Because it's traditional music fans, the same stuff that I love about it. You want it to stay as it was because that's that romance. I totally understand it and didn't not get it. But because we had played bluegrass, you know, I think when those come in, it's like pretending that, I don't know if people thought that. I don't even know what people thought. I didn't let it really get to me.
Yeah.
Because it was just... That was what, you know, in my, I was cool because it's what needed to happen on those tunes that I felt like spoke to me. So,
yeah. So it didn't, because I wondered if you felt that. I wondered if you felt any of that weight. Because there was also the articles were like, you know, is Alison Krauss the future of bluegrass music? And is Alison Krauss like the next great, you know, whether you could possibly have felt any of that for the genre?
I didn't read a lot of things. I always felt like negative or positive that you read could end up affecting your musical choices.
Yeah.
It wasn't where my focus was, but we did. There was a lot of fuss about that particular record. I've got that old feeling. Yeah, that one.
Right.
And I thought we had great songs.
Yeah. 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 I mean, ultimately, musicians just want to make really great music. You know what I mean? And I understand the idea that you find yourself limited by, we want the things to say, we want the Stanley Brothers, the Stanley Brothers. Yeah. We want that stuff to sound like that.
I mean, I understand the mentality of why that would be offensive to traditionalists if someone has been labeled as a bluegrass artist.
Yeah.
And they were making a record that was clearly not that.
Yeah.
And why that would be offensive. Like, are you trying to pretend that this is? No, wasn't trying to pretend. It just made the record. And if that makes sense, it wasn't as conscious. If that makes sense.
Yeah, no. I mean, it rarely is, right? Like, it rarely is anything conscious.
Anything contrived is repelling.
Anything contrived is repelling. Yeah.
Just like I'll use this as an example too. Like anytime, like let's say, like when I was using that example of like changing a word in a song to any of these songwriters, like you have to talk around what the word would be. You know, like say, you have to talk around it, never say the word that it could be, because if you were to suggest a word, it will never happen because it has to come from them. It has to be their idea. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So like you just have to, it's like respecting the filter or whatever that person is coming through. That what I'm saying, I don't know how to, I don't like anything that feels forced or that I'm thinking some outside thing would make me decide how to do something musically.
Yeah.
But I totally understand.
Yeah.
Traditionalists. I think I'm a traditionalist.
Yeah.
You know, like as far as what I love, you know, about bluegrass.
Yeah.
I love that too.
Yeah. You say that in those interviews and people are always asking you, like, do you think you're changing that? And you're like, well, I kind of like what you guys are talking about. Like, I kind of like banjos and fiddles and mandolins. Yeah. I kind of like that kind of stuff, you know? All right. Could I ask you about the O Brother thing?
Yeah.
As I went down in the river to pray, studying about that good old way, and who shall the robe and crown, good Lord, show me the way. Oh, brothers, let's go down, come on down. Come on, brothers, let's go down, down in the river to pray.
As I went with a bit of distance on that, how do you reflect on that time? Because there, at one point, this thing that you had kind of dedicated your life to, and this thing that had been kind of humming along for a long time, and that people who were in bluegrass music had sort of, you know, it was nothing new to them. They loved it and it surrounded their lives. And then it feels like this, you know, this movie happens, then all of a sudden this thing kind of blows up. I heard that you were offered a cameo in the movie, by the way. Is that true?
I was, yeah.
And it didn't end up working out?
I didn't want to do it.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, why would you?
Well, no, I just felt funny. I was pregnant.
Right.
And I was afraid that if something happened there, I would be, you know, just not doomsday. What do they call that thinking? What is it? Like catastrophizing.
Yeah. I do a lot of it.
Yeah. So that's what I was doing. I was like, I don't know if I would have. I don't know. I don't think I. But now, of course, you wish you had, because it would be sweet to have. To be in there, and they were very sweet about it. But
what memory do you have of that time? Like, you did a lot, right? There was like the Grammys, the tours.
Yeah. Oh my gosh, the most beautiful thing to me about that whole thing was how it was represented as is, in a really truthful way, and the way the world reacted to it was nothing. It was nothing contrived about it. All they did was present it as is in that movie, and people loved it. Like, for the same, they went crazy just the same way the rest of the bluegrassers do. T-Bone was so respectful. I mean, he had the two. I mean, I just thought it was just incredible. You know, he stood back there like, didn't want to put his hands on it because he wanted it to be the most truthful, honest version of this, not telling anybody how to do it. Mm-hmm. You show up and be you. I mean, it was beautiful. I just thought, look, how he did that. Someone else who would have had a hold of it could have done all kinds of things to try to put their mark on it. But he put his mark on it by going, I'm just going to capture this as truthfully as it comes out. I just thought it was incredible. And then to see the world love it so much. Mm-hmm. It was an incredible time.
How was touring with Ralph?
Oh, he's great. He's so funny.
Yeah?
So funny. Very comical and friendly.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I mean, like he comes across as extremely stoic and all that, but he's funny.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah.
He like what?
Well, let's see. He had his little nephew there with him. And I remember one time I'm like, let's have a Ralph Stanley parade. And he's like, okay. And so like, you try to kill time with the, during while they're setting up and during the day. And at that time, I think there were 60 people traveling on that tour. So you saw everybody. There were, you know, I don't remember how many buses, all that. And,
yeah.
But like, we put a chair on this little like dolly thing and he rode around, you know, and I pushed him. If he'd just do anything, you know, he'd seen it all.
Yeah, he'd been on the road for like 90 years at this point, you know.
He was always laughing. He wasn't the stoic person. He was a very funny person. I mean, I don't remember ever hearing anything negative before I met him, or he didn't disappoint by any means. He was fun.
I thought what we could do, I know we're getting towards it, but I'm going to take a couple little bit more of your time anyway.
Yeah.
And I'm going to let whoever's in charge of you beat me up.
Okay.
They can break my kneecaps and I'm going to keep talking to you.
Okay.
Yeah, you know why? Because I'm going back to Canada and they can find me. That's what it is. I wanted to say, we thought we could say a couple of names to you and you could tell us like a memory of them or something that they mean to you. And can we start with Tony Rice?
Oh, yikes. I don't even know how to begin there, but that was, you know, to me, his voice and his songs, I thought that's who he was. And I still... Well, that's a tough one. That's as big as it gets, I guess. Oh, boy.
Because you had heard him with J.D. Crowe in the New South. You had heard him sing these songs.
And that's a thought that, you know, you see that person in those stories all the time.
Yeah.
In Likes of Me and all the cold on the shoulder stuff. And I remember getting into who he picked material from. I couldn't believe he wasn't a songwriter. You know, like, because.
Oh, so you see that there, too.
Yeah, I just couldn't believe he didn't write all these things because I saw him. Like, that's who the person you thought it was. And John Pennell, you know, shared with me Gordon Lightfoot, would play me other versions of the songs that Tony recorded. And no, he just was the example of the most tasteful, beautiful records. That Cold on the Shoulder, the Bluegrass Album Band, Native American was so beautiful. Incredible, I mean, the way he... I remember going, what?
Let me reach out, love, and touch you. Let me hold you for a while. I've been all around the world. Have I longed to see you smile? There's a shadow on the moon and the waters here below do not shine the way they should. And I love you just in case you didn't know. Let it go. Let it happen like it happened once before. It's a wicked wind and it chills me to the bone. And if you do not believe me, come and gaze upon the shadow that you don't.
You know, he used a soprano saxophone. Like, and that kind of blew my mind. Yeah. Just, you know, even thinking he would use something like that.
Yeah.
Like, I thought I knew him.
Yeah.
And then, like, that blew my mind.
Did you get to spend time with him when you were touring with him? Because when he did the stuff with Union Station?
I toured some with Tony when I was 15 and 16. And I went and did some shows. And I spent a little time with him, but he was such a hero that I kind of stayed away. Yeah. You know what I mean? Like, but I got to ride in the car with him one time, and he talked about music, and he was playing Leon Redbone for me, and played Benny Goodman, and was talking about that, and that was over the top. You know, you think you know somebody, but, you know, at this point, you know, I always make the joke, he was my Sean Cassidy. Without that whole thing, he was my, yeah. you know, my idol in, like, in whatever. Why did he choose what he chose? Yeah. You know, like, that was where, oh, like, how, why was he choosing? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
that's
yeah.
the part of the, and so those kinds of conversations where, oh, you think somebody is only in that space, but it's all the other things he's thinking about and listening and brings them in here, why that's so unique and beautiful. And, like, you know, it's just a kid's mentality. You yeah. don't think of, does that make sense?
Yeah, no, it makes perfect sense. I can tell how all-encompassing he is for you.
Oh my gosh. And that's, I can't even, it's almost to try to even put your feelings into place about that would probably be nearly impossible, just for how, like, the most beautiful production of anything is Song for a Winter's Night.
The fire is dying now, my lamp is growing dim, the shades of night are lifting. Morning light steals across my window pane, where flakes of snow are drifting. Oh, I could only have you near to breathe a sigh or two. I would be happy just to hold the hands I love and to be once again with you. To be once again with you.
Mm. It's 16 miles.
Mm.
Like, can you believe that?
How about Larry Sparks?
Oh, gosh. I Larry.
This podcast is called I Say Names to Alison Krauss, and she goes,
oh, Larry Sparks.
Did you hear him when you were a kid, too? Like, did
I
you
did.
Hear we talked to him for this thing, too.
You did?
Yeah, we talked to him when, like, a couple months ago.
Can you believe
we that? Think he did his first Zoom call.
Did he? Oh. I did, for him, I used to notice the songs that he did and the messages that he had behind those songs. You don't hear about cheating. You don't hear about all these different things that are really common to sing about. And he won't go there. And it's all those Pete Goble songs, you know, mm-hmm. that are, like, to me, kind of the epitome of the joyful part of that life that we think about when we're,
yeah.
you know, Blue Virginia Blues, all that are just so alive.
Blue Virginia Blues, there ain't no blue like Blue Virginia Blues. There's no girls in the whole wide world can break your heart like Virginia girls. There ain't no blue like Blue Virginia Blues.
And he's kind of the epitome of that purity.
Mm.
Oh, anyway, but I remember I inducted him into the IBMA mm-hmm. Hall of Fame, which did not deliver it that great. I was nervous, but I did an interview with him for that. And I interviewed his wife. I interviewed his son, both sons, actually two of the sons, but you know, and I was like, there's something going on here. Why does he choose these songs that he chooses and not to sing about these other things? Yeah. And I'm like, I want to know why. You know, so, like, I said, can you give me what advice did he give you? What advice did your dad give you about being a man? Like, can you remember? Oh, yeah. And they both came, you know, don't ever, ever give up. Don't ever give up. That was the one thing. And then morals, they talked about morals. His morals were so strong. Yeah. And just the kind of person he is, he's telling the truth. And even though he's not writing those songs, you know, he's telling the truth about himself and what's important through those things. It's, you know, serve, you know, God first.
Yeah.
And don't ever, ever give up. And you know, if you look at that, that is a theme. He doesn't want to sing about some of those other things that aren't him.
Yeah. I have to say, I'm looking for the same thing with you. I'm looking for the why. Like I'm looking for this, like there exists this genre of music that we all really, really love. And then like Alison Krauss and Union Station become this pretty massive thing. And they sell these like tons of records, and they also become so influential. And, you know, I mean, I know I've talked to Sierra Hall and she talks about your influence, and I talked to Sarah DeRose and she talks to me about your influence. And I talked to Molly and she talks to me about your influence. You know what I mean? Like, and I have spent some time like you with Larry wondering, like, is there a prevailing philosophy here? Is there something that she sees in this music or in the way that she wants to give this music that seems to have resonated with so many people? Is there a commonality?
I think his is, for me, it's purity.
Yours is purity.
No, his.
Yeah.
Purity.
Yeah.
Hope.
Yeah.
A simplicity.
Yeah.
Gratefulness.
Yeah.
Like those things, those values,
yeah,
I think come out in what he's choosing. I'm like, like I can only go by the feeling it gives me.
Yeah.
You might give somebody else another feeling, but I know, like, you know, through the years, you most times everything, like I was saying, you don't think why you like something. You just know you do.
Yeah.
But for me, I think it just, those tunes, when you hear them, it just creates, for me, within myself, a longing. That's the thing. It's like, it's a heartache, but it's a longing. And it's not necessarily a sadness, even though it may be a sad message. The longing is, that's the thing. You don't know. That's hard. I don't. That's what I think it causes in me.
Yeah.
When I, you know, that feeling of, oh gosh, you know.
Like, and that's the sort of philosophy you wanted to bring. Like that's the sort of philosophy that you were bringing towards your music. You wanted it to have that longing.
I don't. Not consciously. I think it just. That's just what you find out looking back. If, you know, if someone's asking you, because when people ask you what are you looking for in songs, and you don't really have an answer.
Yeah.
All I know is that if I hear something I love, I'm like, oh God.
Yeah.
You know, it's not pain necessarily.
Yeah.
It's just desire.
Yeah.
You know, it's a desire.
And when you're in the studio and you're making a record, you're listening for that.
I don't think I'm listening. I'm just waiting for feeling.
That's beautiful. The Union Station still going? Is the band still going?
Yeah, we're working on new record now.
A bluegrass record?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, very exciting. I was wondering about it because I haven't heard one in a long time. I didn't.
Yeah, I mean, it was, yeah, I'm thrilled.
Yeah. You see, your relationship with bluegrass is good?
Oh, it's always good. And to me, I love it.
Yeah. To be honest, I thought, like, my God, she spent like 200 days on the road for a lot of her life. I wondered, you know, is she? I wouldn't blame you if you wanted to stop, you know.
Oh, you mean touring in general?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, as older I get, I appreciate being home.
Yeah, I understand that.
But, you know, it's like kind of that, you know, when your purpose or feel like your purpose or that you have something that you feel has validity that will override your comfort or your ease. It's, you know what I'm saying?
That's what I do. Absolutely know what you're saying.
Yeah,
that's like that's so beautiful.
That stuff takes a back seat.
Yeah. That idea of purpose, the idea that you have something you want to give people, that there's something.
Or that you're supposed to, like, I mean, and it's almost like, you know, you're supposed to carry something out to a certain point.
Mm-hmm.
And then you're done.
Mm-hmm.
It's not your You don't have anything to do with what happens after you finish your part of it.
You feel good about the genre. You pay attention to the genre. You pay attention to the, like, how bluegrass is doing right now. Billy Strings is doing really well. You
know? I have heard some of his, and I saw him on the Letterman show, and I thought that was great. I really like that.
Yeah.
But I stay in kind of my old place, you know, with what I listened to as a kid. And I like that. Does that make sense? Like, I enjoy keeping that kind of place sacred. I don't get them out too often because I don't want to get rid of the feeling that I had when I listened to it as a kid, because it really brings back
right.
a lot of stuff. I don't want to mix now with then.
Oh, that's so beautiful.
You know?
Yeah. Allison, thanks for making the time. Really
my pleasure.
It. Yeah.
My pleasure.
Well, how about that? I got to tell you, when I was listening to Alison Krauss, the Now That I Found You compilation, when I was listening to Oh Brother when I was like 14, 15, I never thought I'd be sitting down and chatting with her about it. Allison, we are grateful that you spent that time with us. Thank you so much for doing that. And I'm glad to be a part of you telling your own story. Thanks to everybody at the Bluegrass Situation for making that happen as well. And thank you so much for listening. That brings us to the end of Toy Heart Season 2. Toy Heart is produced by Stephanie Coleman and me, Tom Power. Our executive producer is Amy Reitenauer Jacobs, with help, as always, from the entire BGS team. Creative director Shelby Williamson. Shout out editor Chris Jacobs, who has been making this podcast with me and Steph while I do my daily Canadian public radio show Q, which takes up my entire life. He's been very understanding with me getting stuff to him late and deadlines, and he's an incredible editor. So thank you, Chris, for all your work. Managing editor Justin Hiltner, all of the writers and contributors that make BGS the best source for roots culture redefined. Discover more at thebluegrasssituation.com. Also want to shout out, I know I mentioned her with the executive producer thing, but Amy Reitenauer Jacobs, who again, also incredibly patient with me as we make this labor of love while all having our own lives, and for believing in this project when we sat down together at Folk Alliance, I think in Montreal a few years ago. And I said, hey, I do long form interviews for my living. I want to do them with bluegrass musicians. And I'm thinking if we do a season 3, we should film them and do those like Instagram. We started doing this before the Instagram video thing, so I got an idea. Our theme song, Toy Heart by Bill Monroe, was performed by Chris Eldridge and Kristen Andreasen. If this is your first time listening, you can hear full interviews with Jerry Douglas, Allison Brown, Bela Fleck, Larry Sparks, Jody Stecker, and so many more wherever you get your podcasts. This is the end of season 2 of Toy Heart. If you want to reach the show, we're at toyheartpodcast@gmail.com. If you want to find me on Instagram, I'm @TomJoePower. Thank you so much for listening. See you soon. Later on.